tape of a conversation with James Foreman, June 4. Proceed. Mr. Foreman, do you mind giving us a little autobiographical sketch?
Well, no. My name is James Foreman, F-O-M-A-N. I was born in Chicago, October 4th, 1928. Spent about the first 7 years of my life in the northern part of Mississippi in Holly County called Marshall County, which is in the northern part of Mississippi.
How does that relate to Oxford or Clarksdale?
Well, it's only about 30 miles from Oxford and about 75 miles from Clarksdale. The mail came through a little town called Moscow, Tennessee. Marshall County is adjoining Fayette County in Tennessee. I went to grammar school in Chicago, went to high school there, graduated in 1947, spent 4 years in the Army, attended school at the University of Southern California, graduated from Roosevelt University in Chicago, had a scholarship to attend Boston University, where I majored in African Affairs and was assistant in the government department. Graduate school, spent a year working on a novel while I was working with the Illinois Institute for Juvenile Research. Became a school teacher in the city of Chicago, worked in Fayette County on a vote drive, started the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in September of 1961 as the executive secretary when it decided to put on a full-time staff of some 16 people. I've been working with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee since 1961.
Why did you leave Mississippi when you were a boy?
Well, because my mother remarried and then she came to Chicago.
Were you in the Korean War?
Well, I was in the Army for 1 year during the first part of the Korean War. I was due to get out in 50, and then when the war started, they extended the time for 1 year.
Did you see active service?
No, I was in California at the time, although I was stationed overseas in Okinawa during from 1949-1950.
How did you get involved with the civil rights movement start?
Well, I'm not trying to give you any histrionics. I think that, it sort of started when I was born. I was always conscious of the fact that I was a Negro and that things had to change and that in order for them to change, people had to work to make them change. Now, I'm not saying that as a baby, certainly I had this kind of consciousness. But I was not 25 or 26 years old when it became obvious to me that I was a Negro.
It is for some, though.
Well, that's very true. So they say.
Overnight.
Well, I question that. I don't think that...
Or at least for direct active involvement becomes a matter of something.
Well, I even question that. I don't think that people make overnight decisions, frankly, walking in the apple, in the orchard with your father, I guess like John Stuart Mill, and suddenly you decide this is the idea, I mean, I think that things have more historical context than that. Well, but, it's not for me to say. I mean, people say that, so if that's what they say, okay, but I just don't accept it, and I think that if they probed a little bit deeper than themselves, that they would find other strands.
Let's cut to something about, quotes, the young Negro, close quote, Could you give a kind of a profile of this person, this character, or such subtypes as you might distinguish?
Well, it's very difficult to do. I mean, first of all,
it's difficult to do. That's also a stupid question.
Of getting into the conversation. Now, the reason I say it's difficult to do because, people are always typing individuals, and I've just never been in that school, perhaps due to my own inability to give such typings, to give such generalizations. Well, I think that one could certainly say of those people that I know best, those young people within the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which I'll call SNCC, I spell it out for the typist, S-N-I-C-K is the so-called nickname, that there is, you know, an awareness among some of them that social change has to come, and it only can come by people working full time and most of their spare time in order to make it come about. At the same time, I think that, you know, there exists within this country many young people, both black and white, or certainly many young Negroes that are motivated by traditional American values, the desire to make a lot of money, the desire to be socially mobile, to have a home, two cars, pay partial payment on traveling abroad, you know, and then pay for the rest later on. But at the same time, you have people who are rejecting these values, and certainly this is characteristic of people who work for us, because money is not important. We don't make any money. And the important thing is, you know, working for social change.
I've just been reading a mimeograph or a typescript of a dissertation by a young man named Rose on the American Negro student. He is impressed by the large amount, the large number, large percentage of Negro students who don't involve themselves, who do follow the standard American middle class aspirations.
Well, why is he impressed by it? In what sense is he impressed?
Well, he says the number is great.
Well, it's very true. There's no question about it. I mean, and I don't see how it could be otherwise.
I mean, I don't either. I'm not raising that question.
You know, we have a society which has these values, and Negroes are part of the society, and they're going to accept these values just as many whites do, or, you know, as most whites do. And but that's not relevant to social change, because you don't have to have a whole mass of people who believe in certain things. You just have to have a few people who are dedicated to working for social change and spreading the message. Now, the fact of the matter is, however, that, and you certainly haven't said he made this assertion, but I would challenge anyone to tell me that, you know, the great majority of Negro students don't feel a social consciousness about their being Negro and don't want to see certain changes. But the question then becomes, to them, whether or not I take my time out to work for social change. And in that respect, there aren't that many.
In this question of apathy or personal non-involvement, do you have any notion of the dent that's been made on Mississippi in the last few years about voter registration?
Well, of course. I mean, you know, the fact of the matter is that we haven't registered that many voters. We haven't registered anywhere the number of voters that we could register if the state were a democratic state and permitted the registering of voters. The fact of the matter is it's a police state, and it is consistently erecting barriers designed to prevent the registration. And this is not something which is new. It goes back to 1890 when the Mississippi Constitution, the present Mississippi Constitution, was inaugurated by the Constitutional Convention of 1890 and had as its primary purpose the disenfranchising of Negroes in that state. And this pattern was widely followed by other southern states, and in Mississippi has been successful even until this day.
Let's go back to the students for a moment. What's the relation between activism and two things? One hand, an idealistic motivation, and on the same side, intellectual grasp of questions. On the other hand, the desperation of no direction and of no clear-cut aspiration. So the refuge is taken in activism as an emotional expression. You see what I'm getting at? It's two kinds of motivation, sort of poles of activity.
Yeah, well, I don't, but see, I can't really judge this, but I don't think that there are many people who are involved in the movement simply as an emotional, as an outlet for their emotional frustration solely. Now, there's no question about it that myself, I'm personally frustrated, and that involves my emotions about the racial scene, and that there are certain emotional drives operating in me. At the same time, there's some sort of an intellectual and idealistic commitment, and I don't think that the two are in, the three are inseparable. On the other hand, you know, we're not just like a herd of beings that are just moving forward purely on emotionalism without some type of rationale which would involve our intellect in what we're doing, about what we're doing.
I remember Gilbert Moses talking about this in Jackson, Mississippi, saying he was first shocked to find among freedom riders and other people who came in a type he associated with street corner hoodlumism. You see, the drifters. And he went on to say this first shock passed, so this was their way to become people.
Yeah, well, that's true too, but, you know, first place, I'm not sure the context in which he said this, and I think it's maybe necessary to understand.
He's not saying all, he's saying some.
Yeah, but even I want to even take to the some. You know, it's probably necessary to understand the frame of references from which he speaks, because I don't think that, you know, that it's accurate just to call people street corner types. You know, I think that they're human beings who may not have the so-called formal education, the so-called grasp of intellectual ideas, the so-called worldview that some of us may have, but yet they know that within their own social circumstances or within the context of their environment that there are certain things which are not right, and that they therefore feel that these things have to be challenged and do participate in the movement, and that's very good because racial prejudice doesn't just affect so-called elite Negro, but it affects all people in a sense. And if you're going to have any kind of profound changes, is you must get people whom some would call in the lower classes involved, you see.
This reminds me of something that Adam Clayton Powell said. There are two distinct Negro movements now at the same time. The one in the South is primarily middle and upper class. The protest of people of some education or a great deal of education are claiming their rights, the rights appropriate to what they feel their talents to be. In the North, a mass movement based on the claustrophobia of a ghetto culture.
Well, I just don't think that he understands if that's his statement.
That's
obviously,
rough,
yeah. Obviously, what's going on in the South? I mean, because the movement in the South is not basically a middle class movement. It is based now. There's no question about it. On the other hand, that in 1960. The movement first started, it was led by students who might be considered as middle class students or aspiring to be in the middle class. But it didn't take it very long to become a mass movement involving very poor people. And I could cite numerous examples of the people who have even participated in demonstrations certainly could not be considered middle class. As a matter of fact, the I would say that so-called middle and upper class individuals in the South are not involved in the movement. And sometimes even act as a hindrance.
What about the leadership of the of SNCC, say, itself? The persons I know who are in SNCC, ones I'm acquainted with, are all persons of a high degree of intellectual attainment.
Well, that's very true, and I think that SNCC is the one movement in this country that has within its spheres of activity room for intellectuals. And I think, as far as I'm concerned, is one of the main strengths of our organization, in that we are capable of absorbing the energies of many people with intellectual attainments, but who at the same time are not snobbish. You see, I think that there's a difference between being middle class and having intellectual attainment. You see, the two are not synonymous. And that if people recognize, and the reason, and not only our actions even indicate that they're not synonymous, because the people who come, despite their educational attainment, have to first of all recognize that we're a bunch of equals and that they must work on the same level as, say, a guy or with maybe a high school education that's working for us, and there are a few who don't even have that. And there's a commitment to work with people. We're not working in the major cities. We're working in the very poor areas of this country. And so that whatever your intellectual attainment is, then you have to begin working with the masses of people. And I think that there is a characteristic that's different of the so-called typical middle-class individual.
Do you find this, some of the people who are actually, say, field workers in voter registration, Mississippi, or such places now, who are people of intellectual training and attainments, I'm not offering this as criticism, but have a romantic view, a romantic feeling for the purity of experience of the cotton field hand, the deprived and ignorant. This romantic feeling for the purity of experience, kind of Wordsworthian view of that world.
Yeah, well...
Do you find that sometimes?
No, I don't find that. I obviously don't... Well, not obviously, but I don't understand all of the implications of your statement. I mean, in terms of the Wordsworthian...
Your question, rather.
Because we both come from different backgrounds, in a sense, and I don't... I've not yet attained your literary... level, one might say, but the fact of the matter is, though I do understand it sufficient enough to know that there's sometimes a romantic attachment to poor people, but I don't think that that's the case, you know. And I hope that you understand my ambivalence. I mean, that is, I'm trying to be as concise and perhaps other things, and try to clarify your question and also my reaction.
I can offer you some examples of the contrary.
All right.
Among people you know when they talk about it, you see.
Why don't you do that?
Oh, I have the tapes with me here to play them back to you. But I mean, there's nothing, I think it's fine, you see, but it's one of the things one always enters when you have people of different levels of experience and intellectual attainment assessing each other. Not as condescension, but as a kind of romantic admiration for this purity of experience.
Very well may be the case. But I don't, you know, I just haven't, and one, you know, I haven't talked to everybody within the organization, and certainly haven't talked to them, you know, for 2 or 3 hours at length. But I don't think, now I would, certainly I'm subject to error on this point, and this is just an impression. I'm reacting impressionistic. But I don't just think that there's this romantic conception of purity of experience. I think what people may be saying, on the other hand, is that working in some of the deep South areas, that the issues are somewhat clear-cut. Now, I don't think that this has anything to do with the romantic conception of the purity of the experience. I mean, I think that for instance, in Greenwood, Mississippi, it's quite obvious who the opposition is. It's a different situation from, say, the west side of New York when you're trying to get in a Princeton plan. I mean, where is the opposition? It becomes ambivalent because some Negroes may even present a plan which is counter to that. In Greenwood, Mississippi, it becomes quite obvious that, you know, people can't register to vote. That
shotguns are clear cut.
That's right. And I think that that's entirely different from conceptualizing it as a romantic conception of the purity of the situation. I may be wrong.
Changing the topic a little bit, what do you conceive to be the specific function of stick as contrasted with the other civil rights organizations?
Well, I think that...
What vacuum did it fill?
Yeah, that's right. And the first vacuum was that it decided to go into the small towns and into the underprivileged areas of the Deep South. And it took the movement out of the big cities into these rural areas. That's number one. That can be substantiated. Now, everybody's talking about Mississippi. Of course, all those that are talking about Mississippi are not going to be in Mississippi, you know. But even there, civil rights organizations people in civil rights organizations were vocal about going into the state of Mississippi to talk about voter registration. Secondly, as SNCC fulfilled a need among Southern students to feel a certain unity that had some type of Southern base, in a sense. That is, in 1960, when the sit-in movement started in Greensboro. Two months later, a conference was called in Raleigh, North Carolina. Students themselves voted.
Was that under the auspices of the SCLC?
SCLC called the first conference in Raleigh, North Carolina. Miss Ella Baker, who's on our executive committee, was very instrumental in having that conference. SCLC, I understand, paid for the conference, but the students themselves voted that they would have a temporary coordinating committee which would not be a part of any other organization.
Now, you became an officer at that time, didn't you?
No, I became an officer in 1961.
61.
It was a year and 3 months later, almost a year and 6 months later.
Well, how did you enter the organization?
Well,
What way did you come into the organization?
Yeah, okay, but I want to go back to your question in terms of the the different functions, because I think that this is a question that people are always asking, and I think one has to look at this historically, and that when these students got together and formed this committee, it was basically a Southern organization composed primarily of Negro students who had been involved. And this was a specific function, and even now it's serving a distinctive function in that the primary focus of the organization is not so much in building the organization itself as trying to develop leadership not only in students but also in some of these communities. The mere fact that we have in Mississippi, for instance, spent what is obviously supported 90% of the COFO budget, the most workers in there, trying to create an impression of unity on the part of civil rights organizations working within Mississippi, to the exclusion many times of any kind of projection of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And I think that it's because we feel that ultimately a strong organization within the state of Mississippi will be the best for the people in the state. And we think that this is true across the South, you know, to develop local leadership. And I think that that's a distinctive role, a role which is not in theory, but which we could point to instance after instance after instance of where we have carried that out. And, of course, the converse is not necessarily true. Now, as far as myself, I mean, I got involved in Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee because I first of all felt that young Negroes in this country, and especially young Negroes who had had Southern experience, would have to return South and to lend their technical skills to the development of movements in these areas. And this experience became quite vivid to me when I was involved in the Fayette County situation where people had been put out of their land and living in tents.
Fayette County, Tennessee.
Yeah, that's right. And I was discussing with many people during the summer of 61 the absolute necessity for developing this type of young people's organization. And I met a lot of people who had been involved in SNCC. And it was in the fall when SNCC decided to put on a staff prior to that time. Well, when it decided to put on a staff that I was called and asked to come and work within the framework of this staff. I guess people knew of my commitment, knew of my interest, knew of my work, and perhaps felt that I could make some contribution. And, of course, I decided that I should do this because, one, it was the kind of thing that intellectually I was committed to doing and the kind of thing that I knew was absolutely necessary for social change in this country.
What had you been doing just the year before you came to SNCC?
I'll say I had been working in the Fayette County situation
yes.
from September 1960 to August of 61. I was involved
yes.
in food and clothing drives in the north, sending food there to break the boycott, to which to me was very important because if the boycott had succeeded in Fayette County, then it would have been extremely difficult to talk about voter registration drives in Mississippi.
Well, how did you get into that, into the Fayette County operation?
Well, you know, I could write the history of my life. Well, I got involved because I'd just come back from Middlebury French Summer School, and some friends of mine in Chicago had started organizing to send some food down. Some friends had been involved at the Congress of Racial Equality in Chicago asked me to help them to do public relations work for the campaign, and I agreed to do that.
Earlier, when you were a graduate student at Boston University, how did you plan to do? Go into academic life or into political life or what?
It was all up for grabs, you know. Really, I've never been able to clearly state at any one point in my life that I'm going to be this or I'm going to be that. Or that this is what I want to do. I've been very ambivalent about many things, you know. And the ambivalence revolved, I think, basically around the whole question of whatever it is that I do, how can this best integrate with the conception of doing something for the Negro in the United States.
You say you were writing a novel at one time.
Yeah, that's right.
How did you relate your novel to this question of doing for the Negro in the United States?
Because I wrote a novel about the absolute necessity to develop this kind of a movement so that there was, it was perhaps a bad novel. It's never been published. But some of the themes running through it was the daily frustrations in a northern city. Know that a lot of people encounter, and one of the characters involved tries to break through this frustration around developing a nonviolent movement, which was obviously an expression of something that I wanted to do.
We were talking earlier at lunch about Ralph Ellison, and you said, if I can crudely paraphrase you now, that you had never understood what was meant by a person saying, I want to be primarily a writer or an artist. Is that a fair?
That's right, that's right. Not only that, or a tennis player or a golf player, you know, and then after that, then I want to be a Negro, or I am, or, you know, people stating positively, I am an artist first of all, or I am a tennis player first of all, I am an architect first of all, then after that I am a Negro.
And after that a human.
Yeah. You know, I just don't understand it. I really have never understood what people meant, and I'm not, you know, I'm critical of the position, but in my in being critical, I am sophisticated enough to know that I should understand the frame of references that other people are talking from. But this has never been clearly explained to me.
Maybe it's not a frame of reference, but really a compulsion.
Yeah, I think that you see, I think that there's a lot of it seems to me, what little bit I know about the artistic field, you know, that it's sometimes sophisticated, and to say, you know, that a person is striving to be an artist, art for art's sake, you know. But I've never understood that term. I mean, even in school, and unquestionably, some of this may be my own naivete, but I've never understood what is art for art's sake. What does that mean, you
well,
see?
Some of the greatest artists would deny that,
of course. Tolstoy, for instance.
This is the end of tape one of the conversations with James Forman. Proceed on tape 2.